Hi, everybody. You're listening to the second Gamers Confab that I recorded as part of Podcast 25. In this segment, my guests are Deirdre Kei of Deirdre Kei Productions and Hothead Games, Corvus Elrod of Man Bites Blog, and Matthew Gallant of The Quixotic Engineer. As you'll hear, Matt joins us a little later in the show. So, many thanks to Deirdre, Corvus, and Matthew, and I hope you enjoy. It's my great pleasure to welcome two guests in this edition of the Gamers Confab. One, a return guest, very happy to welcome back, and the other, a newcomer to the Gamers Confab. And I'll introduce the newcomer first. It's Deirdre Kei. She's a programmer at Hothead Games, and she hosts a website called Deirdre Kei Productions, which is devoted to socially conscientious and personally meaningful video games. It's a terrific site, very intelligent and thoughtful conversation about games there. And you can also download some of the games she's designed there, including her latest called The Little Girl Nobody Liked. Deirdre, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yes. I can't wait to talk with you. And I hope my listeners, several people have suggested I have you on the podcast. So we're making some people happy, I think, by having you on the show.
Excellent. I like making people happy.
And, of course, Corvus Elrod, a good friend and repeat confabber. Welcome, Corvus. Corvus is a person probably many of my listeners know already. He writes Man Bites Blog. And in a very exciting development, he's currently in the process of putting together a new open source software platform called the Honeycomb Engine, which Corvus will be unveiling at PAX coming up here very quickly. It is Corvus's participatory storytelling model that I was thinking about this, Corvus. We discussed this on a podcast, you know, ages ago, and you were sort of at that time kind of describing your aspirations for this. And suddenly here we are with the software.
Well, I should clarify that it's actually not software I'm releasing at this point, but a tabletop
role-playing
system.
Okay, right? Yeah.
So, however, I am in negotiations with a studio to create middleware based upon the Honeycomb engine. So the software might be happening much sooner than I had anticipated. It's just a matter of how these negotiations go. So,
Great. And you're going to be running some sessions at PAX. I thought you might want to describe those a little bit and maybe plug them a little.
Well, I'm going to try to spend a lot of time in the board game room at PAX this year when I'm not moderating my panel on Sunday, actually, and Deirdre's going to be one of my panelists for that, along with Nels Anderson and Max Batcher of WorldMaker.net. Damon Brown, the author of Porn and Pong, is going to be on the panel, and Guy Kroll is going to be on the panel. And the panel's called Murder, Sex, and Drugs. It's Sunday from 1 to 2 in the Serpent Theater, right before Will Wheaton's Awesome Hour, so come early for Will, and we'll try to entertain you. But the rest of the time, I'm going to be camped out in the board game room running RPG sessions in which I allow the players to actually challenge me by providing me a genre, an era, and a significant world detail. And then independently of each other. And then I cobble those together into a story world and give you a quick whirlwind tour of my system. It's always a lot of fun to watch people try to stump me with arbitrary and odd world details that I have to try to incorporate. So,
and you've been doing some testing, obviously, leading up to this, and I know you've been sort of burning the midnight oil.
Yes. Yeah, I suspect there's going to be a big collapse happen immediately after PAX.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that, and good luck to both of you, and I hope you have a great time, and I'm incredibly jealous of both of you. I wish I could go. But I'm sure we'll get full reports from you guys.
Of course.
I asked both of you to come on and think about a particular question that I posed to you well in advance, which was to think about the year in games so far. And I was hoping you would discuss what game or person, idea, issue stands out to you as especially notable or defining for first half of 2009, sort of before we get this big game rush that's coming in the next few months?
Well, I thought the most interesting thing, and this was sort of what first popped into my head when you asked this question, was the Dante's Inferno Sin to Win contest.
Yes, indeed. A number of us had something to say about that. I know you were one.
Oh, definitely. I had a lot to say.
Could you describe, because I would expect that there must be some listeners who don't know anything about this, could you just briefly describe what that was all about?
Well, EA's Dante's Inferno team decided to run a contest at Comic-Con, and like I said, they called it Sin to Win. So what they had people do was commit acts of lust with booth babes, and not just EA's booth babes, but any booth babe at the conference. Of course, by acts of lust, they really meant taking pictures, and while trying to cover their ass, they clarified that later on.
So basically, people were going around the show floor with their camera, trying to get themselves into positions or situations with these booth babes where they could be photographed, and then they would submit these photographs to try to win a contest.
Yes, and then the winner would get a night on the town with two beautiful girls, and I think that was about it.
Yeah.
Didn't really hear much about the contest after the aftermath.
Yeah, and there was a fairly significant response to this from sort of all corners, blogs and websites and Twitter, and you know, pretty much all the social media were flaming up about this. Now, this may seem like an obvious question, but let's just lay the right groundwork here. Corvus, feel free to jump in, because I know you have an opinion or two about it as well.
I've actually had myself on mute because I am cursing loudly and I am in tears for our industry at points, and it's been that kind of year so far.
So, Deirdre, what's the problem with this? I mean, what's you were a person who responded to it pretty early, and could you suggest why, to someone who may not initially understand that, why that might be a problem from your point of view, why it is such a problem?
All right. Well, there are two main problems. The first is they are assuming that the only people who would be interested in this contest and this game would be heterosexual men, and probably rather immature heterosexual men with a very superficial opinion of women at that. The language used to describe the contest was very gendered, and it was... And it implied that the contest winner would be the silhouette of a man, and that what he would win would obviously be women. Yeah. So this is exclusionary towards heterosexual women, gay men, and anyone else in the whole sexuality spectrum who doesn't find your conventional buxom blonde woman attractive. Mm. The second problem is that conventions tend to have a history of women being harassed, whether it's people working the booths or whether it's people who just want to dress up and have a nice time. And what this contest was sort of doing was sort of giving an official justification for allowing creeps to continue harassing women. And that made a lot of people uncomfortable.
Now, why can't we just say this was just all in good fun? I mean, it's just, you know, it's a games event, and you know, it's just a big rollicking fun convention with lots of game fans, and you know, why take this so seriously? It's just in fun.
So the obvious comparisons to prostitution, that what you're winning is a date, and what you're being asked to do in order to win a date is further objectify people who have chosen to make their living by being attractive and standing around in public. So there's this idea in our culture that if you're an attractive woman who chooses to put on a revealing or titillating outfit and stand about in public, everything else is fair game. And it's not. It is not okay. And it is not okay to reinforce that notion by saying, oh, by the way, all booth babes are fair game for our contest in which you treat them like sex toys. That's not acceptable behavior on any level. And if I can just real quick make a comparison here, let's say that I went to a car show and I hired a bunch of geeks to stand around, and then I had a bully to win contest in which I told all of these ex-jocks that by getting pictures of themselves, giving Indian burns and swirlies to all the little nerds, was going to get them someone to do their job for a month or do their homework, or, you know, like, it's not okay to reinforce those harmful stereotypes on any level. And it's irresponsible. And I wish that booth babes, I mean, I'm sure that there's got to be a union that supports the models who work these conventions, would sue EA and make a huge example out of them for this.
Were you satisfied, Deirdre and Corvus, you as well, by EA's response to this? Because it did come, the reaction happened rather quickly and very publicly.
The impression I got from EA's response was more of an, I'm sorry we offended you, instead of, I'm sorry that we did this. Or it, like, I'm sorry you were offended, was what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. They took no responsibility for their decision to do that. And let me tell you something about EA. EA is run by lawyers and accountants. And the fact that that reaction came out so quickly indicates to me it was written before the conference.
Mm-hmm. So they planned this, they knew there'd be a fallout, and they got the fallout, and it was all part of the program, you're suggesting?
Yes, that is exactly what I'm suggesting.
So I think, you know, one of the obvious questions then is if Corvus's theory is right, that EA sort of packaged this controversy and managed it in a way, then did it pay off for them? I mean, if you can sort of distance your own personal sense of it, and, you know, obviously if you're offended by what happened. But I wonder, even so, would EA look at this thing and think, yeah, that was good. That worked for us.
Well, judging by their other marketing tactic, which was to have fake Christian protesters outside at, I think it was another convention of some kind, I don't remember. But I don't know, most people that on my circles of the internet think EA's publicity stunts are really stupid and silly and stink of corporateness and... we're just all hashed together, but I have no idea. Maybe a significant portion of their audience is hearing about their game through the controversy, and think that they might want to buy the game because they wouldn't have heard of it otherwise. I don't know. Maybe EA would paint that as some kind of success, but most people I know who I've discussed these processes with, I definitely wouldn't buy the game, and I'm not sure about anyone else. But really, it's just I don't think it's working for just people of my interest level and my personal maturity level, I guess.
I wonder if you're. Sense of that almost confirms the strategy that you're not in the demographic that they're shooting for, that they're targeting with Dante's Inferno, I'm guessing, and that whatever downside there is in terms of a sales loss would be more than made up for by the people who would be titillated and would never have really been interested in the game otherwise. This big controversy brews up. It looks like an edgy game. So now I'm interested and I wasn't.
If it is the case, then I feel sad about the game industry. But if it's not the case, if the falling out was vocal and loud and did really represent a majority, then I'd be more optimistic about the industry, because we'd just essentially be sending out a message that gamers today are not just adolescent males. Gamers today are more mature, and they demand better... And they just demand better from the industry.
Well, I'm curious to know if you think, and Corvus, you probably have an opinion about this as well. How indicative is this Sin to Win contest of kind of where we are in the industry now? That is this a fringe kind of thing that really is kind of an outlier, or are we really still mired in this gamers are these adolescent boys, you know, in their mother's basements mentality?
My experiences in the industry sort of tell me that, especially now that we've been having this recession, I guess the people who are funding games are less willing to take risks, and therefore it seems to me that they want to place more of an emphasis on traditional audiences rather than reaching new ones. But my impression is that, like I said, gamers themselves are changing, and my biggest fear is that the industry isn't going to recognize this.
I have the feeling that the outliers, so the fact that many of people who started gaming in the 80s are now adults and they have their own kids and their own parental concerns, and there's more and more recognition that women are playing games, this is still considered like the edges of the market. So even when we look at the numbers and say, you know, that there's more and more, and in fact, some numbers that I saw recently indicate that like 50% of gamers are women between the ages of 35 and 50. But these are still not considered the core market, even though it's a growing area.
Yeah, they're just saying, yeah, they keep saying like, oh, but they play casual games. They play solitaire on their computers, and those don't count. Those aren't real games.
Hmm. Right, right. So I do sense that the core of our industry is still very focused on appealing to this teenage adolescent fantasy, and there's still this idea that is a holdover from the 80s and early 90s that the demographic with the most disposable income are, you know, young teenage males who get their drugs for free from friends and spend their money on video games. I don't know. Like, I mean, that's really like the mentality that I see echoed throughout the industry. And I don't understand. On the one hand, we've got the creative director of EA saying, oh, the industry is changing and EA is changing to meet the needs of a changing industry. And then on the other hand, we have EA pulling stunts like this.
Yeah.
It's growing pain. I hope it's growing pains.
Mm. So do I.
And not a collapse.
Mm-hmm. There is a kind of an odd schizophrenia, though, about this on a corporate level, that in a couple of weeks, I'm headed out to L.A. for their blogger day that they hosted this again last year for the My Sims franchise. And, you know, they bring people out there and we look at the games and they, you know, they're clearly trying to appeal to a certain group of writers who have a certain kind of audience. And that My Sims franchise is all about family friendly play. And, you know, there's a clear attempt to try to make that a franchise that spreads into other genres, not just Sims types games. So there's that, you know, and when you're there, you notice that these designers and developers have families. There's kids running around. They have daycare. They have, you know, there's this real warm, nurturing sense that you get from EA when you're in that environment, and that My Sims franchise seems to kind of embrace. So that's EA, you know? And then there's EA with Sin to Win.
I think EA doesn't have a very holistic idea of themselves or the industry, and I think they can carve up the markets into these discrete entities that exist completely independently of each other. I really feel that they're restructuring, however, what was that, a year ago, 2 years ago, where they now have EA Casual, EA Sports.
EA Girls.
They've got, I think they consider EA Girls to be part of EA Casual. Like they've restructured their business model. So they've got the business that still does all the asshattery, and then they've got the one that just focuses on cranking out iterations of sports franchises. And so I think they don't see that what they do in one area impacts people's perceptions of the rest of what they're doing. And maybe by and large, it doesn't. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that, because another way of looking at this is, look, this is just good corporate strategy. You don't want to target just one part of the market. So EA is looking at who buys their games, and they're trying to broaden, expand their market by identifying more than one or two demographics and serve all of them. And they're a big company, so they can do that.
So what I'm just thinking here is that I think it's perfectly fine to broaden your market. But the problem I have with EA is that they're trying to, that some areas of their marketing excludes other groups. And I guess maybe it's part of the adolescent male culture to exclude everyone else in a sense, maybe. But this definitely contributes to the schizophrenia you're talking about. And yeah. I guess, like, just morally and ethically, I see it as a bit of a cognitive dissonance, and it makes me not want to buy anything from EA, even though I might really like the Rock Band franchise, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where things get tricky, I think, because to me, I frankly don't care if they want to make games that appeal to, you know, whatever highest, lowest, medium common denominator that there is out there. If they want to target, you know, boys that like boobs and they want to sell games, sell games. There's a difference between targeting different audiences with the games you make and going to a convention, an expo or whatever, and taking that entire audience and dragging it through this crap. Right?
Right.
That's a whole different thing. Well, let's transition here, and this gives me a chance to introduce and welcome Matt Gallant. Matthew wasn't able to connect with us at the beginning, but as we've been talking, he's popped in. You may have heard little bleeps and blurps that I've been recording, so you'll know what those were. So Matthew, welcome. Matthew writes The Quixotic Engineer, a blog about nerdy things. He's a repeat confabber, always glad to have him on. And his most recent post, which you should definitely check out, is about mechanics, dynamics, and aesthetics, which he describes as the three layers that define a game. And it's a sort of typical Matt Gallant post. It's very thoughtful and smart, and but easy to read and understandable to people who may not necessarily be academics or game design majors. So welcome, Matthew, and it's good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. It's terrific to be back.
All right. Well, I want to transition over to Corvus, and I asked Corvus obviously the same question. Corvus, I'll toss the ball to you.
Well, actually, the recent discussion about EA and whether or not we should consider not buying the franchises of EA that we do like that are marketed to us, Beatles, Rock Band, Brutal Legend, things like that, in protest of their behaviors around other titles that we might not have been buying anyway. I want to talk a little bit about Orson Scott Card, a game called Shadow Complex, and another writer named Peter David. So Shadow Complex is an Xbox Live Arcade game. It's available for download. It's a side-scroller, very Metroid, Castlevania sort of style. It's done with the Unreal Engine, so, you know, it's pretty. And a lot of people have had a lot of fun with it. However, Orson Scott Card is on the board of directors of the National Organization of Marriage and has been very vocal about same-sex rights and made several very controversial comments about governments that would allow such a thing to happen. And a lot of people are very conflicted because they do not want to support him in any way. And a lot of other people say, well, he's hardly getting any money. You're punishing Chair, the developers. You're punishing the people who work for Chair. It was suggested on Gay Gamer that perhaps if you did want to buy it, you could donate money to an organization that supports gay rights. So you could sort of offset the cultural impact of Orson Scott Card while you bought into it at the same time. And I was going to go this route myself until I read a opinion piece on Gama Sutra from Christian Nutt. And actually, it wasn't his opinion piece that got me worked up again. It was Peter David's comments on the opinion piece, in which Peter David basically says that what we ought to do to prove to Orson Scott Card that we are bigger people than he is buy the game and support Chair, which is a logical approach that confuses me, frankly. Also, particularly considering that Chair actually is the creative force behind this franchise and specifically went to Orson Scott Card to recruit him to write for it, makes them very, very culpable in bringing more attention to Orson Scott Card and his cause, frankly. So it's a very complex issue, and a lot of people are very upset. I've had people get really mad at me because I've chosen not to buy the game. And ironically, I'm not choosing not to buy it because of Orson Scott Card. I'm choosing not to buy it because I think Peter David comes across like just a complete, irresponsible moron in this thread. And after reading all of his comments, I realized that I had already spent more time on this creative franchise than I felt was warranted. And I wasn't going to spend more time playing it, particularly when the demo itself pretty much outlined the entire plot for me in a very obvious, ham-fisted fashion. So I didn't figure I'd get much out of the gameplay or the storytelling. So my reasons for getting it kind of evaporated.
Now, we should just be clear, too. He is...
Peter David is a writer who wrote the game that's based on the world created by the developer in which Orson Scott Card has written novels. It's a complicated creative relationship. But Peter David is actually considered to be a writer who, although a heterosexual male, is very friendly to the GLBT community. He has created gay characters, prominent gay characters in comic books. He has said that he includes gay characters in his writing because it never occurred to him not to. So, I mean, it isn't Peter David's stance on that issue that I'm taking umbrage with. It's Peter David's interpretation of capitalism and his saying that that we have no right to boycott. He's almost saying that we have to buy everything that comes down the pike to support creative people, regardless of their political ideas or our political ideals. But the reason I actually wanted to talk about this is because I think it's an important conversation, and I'm very encouraged that for the first time in quite some time, we're having a very involved, complex adult discussion, by and large, on mainstream media sites about social issues as they apply to video games. Mm-hmm. And I'm really encouraged by that. Like, regardless of how you feel, whether you bought it and you don't see that it's a problem, whether you bought it and donated, whether you decided to do a personal boycott to not engage with that media, I think that the very fact the conversation has been happening so thoroughly is a really good thing for our industry.
And this is despite, you know, on these mainstream sites, some very vocal commenters saying, you know, oh, it's just a game. Why are you worried so much? It's kind of happening in spite of that.
Right.
People not taking this seriously. People wanting to return to this kind of very childlike view of video games where they're just pure fun and nothing else.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. If you track back to conversations on various sites, that it's just a game argument, you know, it wasn't long ago that argument could sort of rule the day. And just by volume, just a number of people would be like, get over it, it's just a game. That argument seems to increasingly get shouted down, even on the most crazy websites and forums. That it as Corvus suggesting, I think we've broken through some kind of barrier that says games aren't worth talking about, and it's not worth knowing who wrote it, or it's not worth knowing who made it. That in fact it is, and that we've kind of started to win that argument.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I think even more encouraging, the it's just a game arguments aren't even really being shouted down anymore. They're just sort of being ignored.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, well, that's fine if you want to remain culturally naive and detached from your community, which is us, you go ahead and do that, because we're going to be over here discussing important things.
Yeah.
You go sit at the kids' table and play Dante's Inferno, and we'll sit over here. We'll sit over here and have, you know,
and play Little King Story.
Yay.
Which I still can't find in Canada.
That is not right.
Yeah.
That is a crime.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to borrow it from Nels sometime.
Well, yeah, I know Nels has played it, so yeah. Well, Nels Anderson works at Hothead with you, and we'll have him on a separate segment of the Gamers Confab. So but Corvus, I'm still shuddering by, you know, the image of children at a children's table playing Dante's Inferno.
Well, no, see, and that runs us into further complexities about the cultural impact of video games. Is Dante's Inferno, which is okay, so we keep saying Dante's Inferno, and if people haven't heard of this yet somehow or haven't been paying attention, we are not talking about an intellectual game grappling with issues of morality. We're talking about a God of War clone.
If you want to play a game that is grappling with issues of morality, the guy who did Les Miserables, the game, is releasing one called Dante's Divine Comedy, based on the sort of same literature.
I know there was also a TIG Source competition to develop a game based on Dante's Inferno before EA could release theirs.
Yeah.
And it also, but then like, so my point about the Dante's Inferno thing is, so we have this game that aspires to having some sort of literary pretension, at least in its name. That is, and it's using adult themes of, you know, excessive violence and hyper sexualized characters, and it has no more intellectual or social content than something that would appeal to a teenage boy. Like, so is this the whole Sin to Win campaign is exactly reflective of what this game is going to offer. It is sugary breakfast cereal pretending to be a nutritional meal. And that very fact concerns me. Like, kids media and media aimed at the youth of our culture needs to have substantive content.
It's funny too that, I mean, the game that inspired this kind of conversation was Shadow Complex, which in and of itself doesn't have a lot of content either.
No, it
just
really
kind
doesn't.
Of incidentally getting people talking about, you know, gay rights
and that's,
issues.
Right, and that's one of the things that's so fascinating to me about Shadow Complex is Shadow Complex makes no statement about homosexuality, no overt statement about homosexuality or left-wing and right-wing politics. However, given that it is a franchise based upon someone who has these very conservative views, I believe it clearly reflects those views, even if it isn't overtly speaking about them. We have this notion that someone like, and this actually comes up in the conversation thread in the Gama Sutra piece, what about Duke? What if David Duke wanted to do some sort of game based upon his wildlife photography? Would you support that and work with him on it if it wasn't directly connected to his politics? But of course it's directly connected to his politics. If he has a voice in the development of a narrative piece, which video games are narrative because they're moment to moment, your perception of things changes as they happen, game mechanics describe relationships, then there is subtle programming happening. There is a subtle conversation happening between you and the creator of, you know, the primary creative force behind this piece. And whether they are intending to or not, they are communicating something about their worldview.
Yeah, and it's just sort of undercutting the whole love the art, hate the artist kind of thing, that kind of cognitive dissonance people go through when there's like, oh, well, say this painting is really beautiful. Who cares if the person who created it was a horrible misogynist and homophobe or whatever?
Let's say Birth of a Nation, very important film, but clearly inspired by hate and, you know, horrible values, but at the same time, very important to, you know, the development of film techniques.
I also want to separate out the intellectual critique approach to analyzing media by past artists. I consider that very important.
But we're in the present right now, course.
When we're in the present and that piece of art is actually a marketed product designed to fuel an industry, we have a different set of responsibilities regarding that product.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think we fulfill our responsibility to our culture by discussing it. And I think we can do that even if we don't participate in the consumer side of it and buy it. And a lot of people are saying, well, you can't discuss the issue if you don't buy the game. The issue isn't with the game. The issue is with the machinery that produced the game. So, of course, we can talk about it.
Right. The ideology that's fueling it.
Correct.
But in 5 years, what we'll remember about Shadow Complex is this conversation.
Yes, indeed.
It's just a game. I mean, and that's the only time I would make that argument. It's just a game. That it's the game itself. I've not played it, so I shouldn't say anything definitive about it. But it appears to be a pretty solid game, a well designed game. Gameplay seems solid. People like it. But you know, it's not Birth of a Nation. It's not that nobody's cutting any edges here. So ultimately, it's this conversation that will, and all the, I think we've learned from this conversation that we'll reflect on. I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
So Matthew, you want to take us in a slightly different direction?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can draw a tangent between what I had planned to talk about and what we've been talking about previously, like Corvus did. But when I got the email from you just kind of asking, you know, you wanted to talk about the first half of 2009, you wanted to talk about games and issues and things that had happened. I could think of a few issues, but just looking back to kind of the games I've been playing in the first half of 2009, I realized the titles that really stood out so far have been independent games. I mean, already looking at last year, 2008 was just a gigantic year for indie games. It was really, I'd say, the year indie games hit the mainstream. You had Braid coming out, World of Goo, Castle Crashers, N+, Pixel Junk Eden. You also had, you know, WiiWare titles like Lost Winds coming out, and just a terrific selection of indie games coming out. Many of them on, you know, the big consoles, the Xbox, downloadable over the internet. I just thought it would be interesting to look at, you know, how that's continued in 2009, and there's really still been a lot of momentum in the indie scene. For instance, have any of you had a chance to play a Xenoclash?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wrote about that game a couple of times, actually.
Corvus and Deirdre?
I haven't, no, I'm sorry.
Neither have I.
I would say that's probably been one of my favorite games that's come out this year so far. I think Duncan Fife described it as, you know, a game where you go into this terrific kind of punk fantasy world and then beat it up.
Yeah, it's an amazing game. I mean, I wish that more people gave it a look. I don't know. It probably seems, when you at first glance, to have nothing special going for it. You know, and if you don't happen to have looked at the artwork, which I think is extraordinary, and the kind of the setting of the environments, and the just the general aesthetic of the game, if you just maybe have only seen a simple screenshot and maybe a brief description, it's a brawler. And it's downloadable, Steam, it's how much money, okay, whatever, I'm not interested. And you'd sort of totally miss what that game's all about.
Actually, yeah, now that I keep forgetting the name of this game, but it's one of the ones this fall I'm going to be reinstalling Windows on a primary partition, and so I can play some more, well, actually, so I can play IGF entries, because I've been asked to be a judge this for next year. But Xenoclash is one of the games that I'm very interested in downloading and playing once I've got a native Windows install again.
Yeah. It's I'm sorry, Matt, I don't want to take it away.
No, go for it, please.
It's a Chilean developer, and they're,
I think, three brothers or something like that.
Yeah, it's a very tight knit group of people who've sort of collectively been working on this for some time and have a grand vision. This is a game that is a starting point for them to continue with this world that they've created, and it is a very interesting skewed vision of human existence. They're very ambitious thematically, and I'm tempted to say for a brawler, you know, but actually the brawling is really integrated in thematically into what that game's all about, just the sort of raw brutality of it. But anyway, I'm really glad you mentioned Xenoclash, Matthew, but I know you've got some other indie titles that have caught your eye as well.
Yeah, definitely. And another one that I think is one of your favorites been this year, The Path. Yeah. Came out in 2009, and that's just been a tremendous game that's inspired a lot of conversation in indie circles and on kind of the blogosphere.
Yeah, I'm curious, do you find, at your place in life where you're going to be transitioning into a career, do you find it encouraging the way this is unfolding, this indie games movement, and the momentum that it's gained?
I think it's incredibly inspiring. Like even Matthew Wasteland, whose real name I can't remember, but you know, recently said on Twitter that he's leaving his big company and going to found a indie studio. I wish I could remember the names of both the indie studio he's founding and the big company he's leaving. But
it's Shady Grass or
Shade Grown, I believe.
Shade Grown, that's it. Shade Grown. Yeah, that's the name of his company.
I mean, I every time I hear stories like this, it's incredibly inspiring, just because I think it does take a lot of courage and a lot of kind of belief and conviction to go out and try to make an indie game for a living. The numbers, from what I've seen on, you know, Darius Kazemi's posts and other people just talking about, you know, how do indie games make money? How do these people support themselves? And it's tough. Unless you get a lot of success or you develop like a really big library of titles to support yourself, it can be difficult. As much as, you know, video games are a very, very big industry, indie developers are still having trouble finding good vehicles to just make some money.
Yeah.
But it's tremendously inspiring to see people pursuing their dreams like this and going for titles that they find personally inspiring.
I think I've got a tie-in for you here, is that there are so many developers that are fed up with the machine that is ignoring the cultural impact of their medium that they love and that they want to use to communicate with an audience, that indie is becoming more and more attractive. And we have more and more business models where indie can work. And yes, it's tough. Yes, you have to stand out somehow. Yes, you have to do ruthless self-promotion. But it can be made to work. I know several developers who are making good money, making a living off their titles.
Indeed.
Because they just hit the right, you know, they just hit the right spot. They hit the sweet spot. Some of them are on Steam. Some of them are on Xbox Live Arcade. So,
and those are channels that didn't exist, say, 2 years ago.
Exactly.
Xbox Live Arcade was at where it's at now. I don't think
right.
WiiWare was really supportive of indie devs. I mean, just all of this has come in the last couple of years, and I think indie developers are really jumping on it and saying, just they're not even jumping on it. I think it's the company is kind of catching up to what's been happening and wanting to give, you know, wanting to get, they see these games on PC, on, you know, Flash, and they say, you know, we want titles like this.
Right. And so I see that as being a direct response to the other issues that we're talking about. Because if you really want to grow up, you have to move and do this as an art form, do this as a storytelling form, do this as a means of communication of your own ideals and ethics. You have to go to an area of the market that is not as risk adverse. And that means lower budgets. That means smaller teams, more personal expression through your content. And I think that's really encouraging.
Think about the game Spider, this new iPhone game. Has anyone played it?
Yep.
It's terrific, yeah.
You know, Randy Smith, you know, has a lot of experience. David Kalina, they sort of co-found this new company with, you know, tremendous industry experience, a very small team, and the evidence that the industry is hungry for and will support this, these new emerging markets and these new kinds of games, is that you've got people who could make a real good living in the mainstream industry leaving it to start their own little companies. And it's happening all over the place.
Yeah, we're seeing it more and more, definitely.
Yeah.
I think the economy is actually helping with that. As everybody's tightening their belts, I think we're all getting used to living on a little less. And that makes it easier to make that indie jump as well.
Mm.
So, Matthew, do you feel like indie games have they arrived in terms of the mainstream market, the sort of Joe average gamer, whoever that person is? Are they aware of indie games? Do they download them like we do? I presume they don't, but are they, in your view, are we at the point where there's very little separation in the minds of gamers between mainstream publishers and developers and indie developers?
I think the biggest thing I've seen just in kind of my circle of friends that are more mainstream gamers, they'll play more, you know, the Halo type titles, is that the titles that have had the most success are the ones that have been on consoles. So for instance, when World of Goo came out, I was telling a lot of people, you know, oh, it's terrific, you should try it out. And I think the ones that actually went and, you know, checked it out, it was on the Wii. It wasn't necessarily on the PC. Mm-hmm. Same as, you know, games like Braid, Castle Crashers, N+. I think just because they're so immediately in the console, people can just kind of check them out. Just, I mean, not to kind of crap on PC or anything, but just I've seen a lot more people who wouldn't necessarily check out indie games doing so on those kind of streams than necessarily Steam, than necessarily, you know, the great ecosystem that PC provides.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'll be a big step forward for indie games if it can happen, is if more people will check out games on the PC.
Yeah.
And I think one way that can really be done. Oh, no, please go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so personally, like when you said mainstream, I thought you meant mainstream, and not mainstream gamers. And I would say that with the mainstream, the PC actually is a better platform, whether it be through through casual games, portals, or through Flash games, it's very easy for me to show a non-gamer friend of mine a Flash game that I've made, as opposed to, say, trying to get them on a console or trying to download something on Steam.
Definitely. I was actually just about to kind of backtrack a little there and say, except for Flash, kind of on the PC side. I mean, I actually just kind of shared on Google Reader the game Little Wheel, which I'm not sure if you guys have checked out. It's a nice little adventure game about this robot in kind of a post-apocalyptic world where all the robots are shut down, but he gets hit by lightning and has to kind of revive the world.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's got a great jazz soundtrack. It's got beautiful art. It's by a small independent developer from somewhere in Eastern Europe, I believe. So, and, you know, I just shared this on Google Reader, and a few days later, I had a bunch of my kind of, I mean, nerdy friends, but not necessarily gamer types, come up to me and say, oh, yeah, I tried out that game, Little Wheel. I really enjoyed it. And I think, as you said, it's only because Flash has that immediacy of just, you don't have to download anything except for the plugin that everyone has. You don't have to set up anything. You don't have system requirements most of the time. It's just click on this URL and try out the game. It's lots of fun.
Do people care who makes games anymore? Is there a connection in the minds of most gamers between a game and the publisher? I mean, maybe Madden, people know EA makes that or whatever, but in general, is that something that even is a factor?
I would say personally not.
I would have to agree. Yeah.
You know, when I had a friend of mine, again, just kind of an anecdote, but he told me, oh, yeah, I just torrented a copy of World of Goo. And I was kind of yelling at him saying, you know, this is two guys. You know, they made this game. This is like, you know, you should really be supporting them. They're doing something really cool. And, you know, you're kind of robbing from the littlest guy there is. And to him, like, there was absolutely no connection. You know, it's a game I wanted to play. I'm going to go torrent it.
Yeah.
So I think absolutely people have no idea how big the teams are making their games, who it is, where they're from. There's no connection at all.
Yeah,
I think they want to know, though. I mean, like, I sort of get the feeling that people would like to know who made their games, and especially if I've made something, they're more likely to play it because they know me and they know what I stand for, and they know they'll like it just because, oh, I wrote it. And for me, it was a lot like this back when I was younger and playing games by, say, Ron Gilbert and Tim Schafer. And and like, it's like, I know who created this game. I know the company. I know the values. And I know it's going to be an adventure game that's not punitive and I'm not going to die. And I like this. So I bought their games because of this. And I don't think this was, I'm not sure whether this was common in the industry at the time or not, but I think somewhere along the way that got lost. And
as team sizes got bigger, I suppose. Once you have a team of 50, 60 people, you don't have that strong authorship as much unless you really push for it.
Like, right. Plus we had the rise of publishers who wanted to reduce authorship and focus on IP. Mm-hmm. It is not in the publisher's best interest to have a name attached to an IP, because if that name starts being quarrelsome and leaves and you still have the IP, no one's going to play it if they know, like, oh, well, you screwed over that developer. So it's in the publisher's best interest to associate games with the label, not with the individual. But I'm gonna actually disagree a little bit. I usually try to get a part-time job somewhere where I can watch mainstream America talk about media. And a lot of times that's like a video game rental or a movie rental store. And there's a high quotient of nerd culture in the video game industry because of the nature of the video game industry. And I think that because of that, we are under this impression that the mainstream gamer, the core gamer, really does care about who makes the games and who the voice is. But I'm not sure that's true of the mainstream player who buys an Xbox or a Wii, because when I've talked to these people about movies, like, you know, Cloverfield, that's directed by J.J. Abrams, and they go, oh, who's that? Where anybody who's slightly nerdy and into movies knows the name J.J. Abrams and can, you know, recite his creative impact on the medium. And the same thing with video games. I think that there is a higher level or a higher number of people who pay attention. But as the market grows and more soccer moms are playing Wii games, the less and less it's going to have an impact on their perception, unfortunately. That doesn't mean it isn't important.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we still need those names. We still need people trying to communicate through the medium. But I think that as our audience grows larger, so that we can be better supported by doing this, it is, they're going to play a game and they're going to know they like it. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to pay attention to the name on it.
Yeah. Mm. Deirdre, when you make a game, do you feel like it's important that you're communicating a certain set of personal values that your reader, if you will, can associate with you, that you have a certain kind of relationship with that player?
Absolutely.
At what point does that go away? I mean, if you added 3 people to your team, 10 people to your team, how where's the cutoff point where that might be less possible?
Well, if it were like 2 or 3 people, like if I were to work in a 2 or 3 person game, which I haven't successfully done yet, I would want the sort of vision of the game to be like that of the 3 of us. We would all have creative input, and our shared vision, our shared message would be the message that the personal values that we collectively share would come through in that game. So now once it gets a bit bigger and I have sort of what I feel is less creative influence over projects, I don't know, I get the feeling that there's a certain point where the message people are trying to send gets diluted somewhat. The project I'm working on right now at Hothead, Deathspank, it's sort of meant to be Ron Gilbert's vision, and which I support. I have a lot in common with him. So so when he was first telling me what his whole vision for the game was, it was something I could really support and really treat as if it were my own. But like as more and more people got attached to the project, and now there are, I think almost the entire company is working on it right now. And somewhere I felt that the message has gotten lost in a way. It's become more of like sort of, okay, now I'm working on a factory. I'm just working on a little piece of this and here and there. And I don't know how these all fit together as well. And I'm just figuring out this is a big part of game industry life. So
yeah,
that's that.
It's interesting that you say that, just because I find it very interesting when you have games that, even though they're developed by a big company, are still, you know, really strongly authored. When you see, you know, like a Suda 51 game or a Hideo Kojima game, when you can really see, you know, that despite the fact that many people worked on this game, there was one kind of dictator at the top saying this is exactly how it's going to be.
So interesting that you just named 2 Japanese developers.
Well, I guess from the more American or North American Western side, that you'd have, you know, Peter Molyneux, Tim Schafer, as people who are, you know, produce games that are very much have their kind of fingerprint all over them.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious to see, you know, there are a lot of indie developers that have a very, you know, strong sense of style. You know, you see a Cactus game and you know, oh gosh, that's very obvious. You see a, and I'm sure I won't pronounce his name right, a Daniel Ben-Megui. The person who made Today I Die and I Wish I Were the Moon. Mm-hmm. I mean, his games are very...
He is just an individual developer as well.
Indeed, right, but I'm curious if
how it would
if,
work
if these people ever went, you know, to bigger companies or to bigger things, kind of like how Jason Rohrer is doing right now, you know, going to a bigger ad firm where he'll probably be collaborating with more people and working together. Will that sense of authorship persist? Will it continue?
Right.
As somebody who has been... making singularly authored games longer than I have worked as a team, it's been a little bit discouraging to sort of work on a team. And this is maybe because I'm coming in as like a more junior level sort of programmer than as a creative lead. But it's just a little bit, it's discouraging at times to sometimes to try and make my voice heard, but then just have it sort of silenced by people who've been around longer than I have. And so I find that even though I'm working in the industry now, I still keep going back to making my own games, because I need that creative outlet, and it's something I can't yet satisfy in a commercial setting.
And as someone who really, really enjoys your personal expression through your games, I'm very glad that you are not going home exhausted and going, I'm not doing any more game design, but going home and creating those projects for us. So thank you for being that type of person, Deirdre.
Indeed.
You know, I'm glad.
Deirdre, you remind me of one of my favorite filmmakers is John Ford, and he was famous for saying, he said this many times, that he would make one film for the studio and one for himself. and he was fine with that. He did good work for the studio, but when he had that done, he was ready to do his own project. And
like the LucasArts model with the one Star Wars game, then one crazy adventure game.
Matthew, you wanted to jump in real quick before we wrap here?
Yeah, I just wanted just kind of a quick wrap up of some of the indie games that I think you guys should definitely check out if you're listening and you haven't played them already. So in 2009, we've seen games like Xenoclash, The Path, Crayon Physics, which was released in January. Little Wheel is a terrific full flash game. Today I Die, a beautiful kind of poetry-based game. We've seen Spider, The Secret of Bryce Manor on the iPhone, which is a lovely game. We've seen a lot of indie mods, or I guess most mods are indie, but they have Dear Esther, Research and Development, Neo Tokyo, coming out this year. And one title, which I'm not sure actually if came out in 2009, but it's nominated for the 2009 IGF, is a game called Tag, The Power of Paint. I've written about it on my blog before, but it's just a terrific, terrific game, and I feel the need to champion it a little. It's a game that's a little bit like Portal, without so much of the narrative element, but just from a mechanical sense. You have a paint gun, and you paint the walls, and then that paint gives certain effects. So if you paint a wall green, I believe, it bounces you, so you jump really high. If you paint it red, you run really fast. If you paint it blue, you stick to it, and you can turn upside down. It's a terrific game. I haven't seen it get a lot of attention, so I'd very much encourage you guys to check it out.
Very cool. Well, we're out of time, and I want to thank all three of you, Matthew Gallant, Deirdre Kei, Corvus Elrod. I've really enjoyed this conversation, guys. This has really been fun, and thanks for thinking so hard about what we wanted to talk about in advance. It made for good conversation, I think.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you very much for having us.
You
Take
bet.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.